Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. I'm afraid this week I'm following in the footsteps of my colleague Chris, in that I've got a bad lurgy, which, although it hasn't affected my voice too much, it means I keep coughing. So anything I say will be kept to the bare minimum. Thank goodness for that, they all say. What this means is I'm not going to give you a detailed rundown on what's coming up in the programme. You'll just have to listen and hear for yourself. With that in mind, what I will tell you is that the first item is an interview that Maya Davis did with Louise Pym of the Ageing Well Festival. Maya began by asking Louise why the festival had changed its name, having been run for many years as the Older People's Festival.
Well, the Ageing Well Festival was kind of rebranded when the Ageing Well service was established. So for 4 years it was the Older People's Festival, and then when we launched the Ageing Well service in Brighton and Hove, we rebranded the festival the Ageing Well Festival. And we just really think that Ageing Well encapsulates everything that the festival represents. So it's just about encouraging people to take part in activities that promote their general health and well-being, and enabling people to age well for longer.
Right, so do you have any minimum or maximum age limit for participation?
Our Ageing Well service is for people aged 50 plus in Brighton and Hove, and the festival is very much targeted at people aged 50 plus, but also we really want to encourage people of all ages to participate, and yeah, we would welcome people of any age.
Does it differ in any way from what's been happening in past years?
I think this year, for obvious reasons, it's been challenging in some ways to coordinate a festival with the ever-changing government restrictions and guidance, but we were really sure that we wanted to deliver an engaging 2 weeks, providing some opportunities for people to have fun and to connect with like-minded people and be inspired. So we've collated a mix of online and live events to ensure that people can participate safely and that they have a wide range of choice in the activities that they participate in. And we've chosen our theme of creative aging to very much kind of fit in with the recovery from COVID, because we really understand that older people have been very adversely affected by the pandemic, and we wanted to create opportunities for people to engage in creative classes and workshops to kind of aid their recovery from what's been a very challenging 18 months.
Can you give me some idea of some of the workshops and events that you're producing?
Yeah, so we're really excited this year to welcome the Theatre Royal, and they have a free drop-in workshop called Age is a Stage, and they use physical comedy. So the workshops will be around 10 minutes, and it will be a full day, so anybody can drop in and there's no charge for that. We have a lot of dance events, so regardless of your kind of ability for dance, it's just an opportunity to come and engage in some movement. So we also have music classes from Moving Sounds, and one of our partners for the Ageing Well service, Music for Connection, are doing some music workshops. The University of Brighton are holding a digital storytelling workshop, so that's just an opportunity to learn how you might tell a story through digital media. We have Dance Awareness doing a Strictly Not Strictly.
How does that work?
Strictly Not Strictly. It's a fun dance event, you know, where the there's a lack of competition, I'd say. It's more about just having fun. We have lots of cooking classes and art classes, photography. Brighton and Hove buses are on board to do their open air bus tour of the city, whilst giving some information about the history of Brighton and Hove. So there's lots and lots going on. And we're really pleased that the Met College are on board and are delivering a whole series of events. We're just really encouraging people to have a look at the programme when it comes out, because there's such a wide range of things to participate in, and many of them are free.
Can I just ask whether you have earmarked any events as being particularly suitable for people either with dementia or caring for people with dementia or other disabilities?
Our Ageing Well service is always inclusive of people living with dementia, and we know from delivering groups and activities that the creative arts can be extremely effective for people living with dementia. So one of our partners, Music for Connection, who deliver workshops for people specifically living with dementia using music and movement, they have a workshop, and also our other partner, Brighton and Hove Food Partnership, they will be delivering their gardening session, which is tailored. They deliver sessions tailored for people living with dementia. But that is something that Ageing Well as a Service has now taken on board, and we are delivering a programme of activities and services specifically for people living with dementia. So I do encourage people to give us a call if they're looking to engage in specific activities. Our partner in Munich are coordinating alongside Brighton and Hove an audio dance event. So that's taking place on the day of the International Day for Older People, the 1st of October. And it will be a dance lesson led using earphones. So everybody will have their own set of earphones, and somebody will kind of talk them through the dance, and that will be down on Hove Lawns. And Munich will be doing the same dance at the same time, and there will be screens. So the dance will be live streamed. It will just be a really good opportunity for us to connect with Munich, especially during this time when travel is limited.
That sounds really exciting. Is there anything that involves local people actually presenting or organising events, say singing or acting, without any support from professional organisations? There's a reference to something by Whitehawk Warblers. Who are they?
Oh, so they're a choir in Whitehawk. So they will be doing an event alongside Whitehawk Football Club, which we as Impact Initiatives are also involved in. So there's a lot of small community-based organisations who are facilitating events alongside the kind of bigger, more established creative agency. So it's a real mix.
Right, so there are opportunities for local people to get involved, but they need to have sorted themselves out already.
Yes. So we did a big call out. It's been in the making for about 6 months, this festival, but we ensure that we approach all manner of different sized organisations and make it as accessible as possible.
That sounds really exciting and really interesting. You've mentioned this organisation Ageing Well on several occasions. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and who makes it up?
Ageing Well is a programme of activities and services for anybody aged 50 plus living in Brighton and Hove. And it was launched in 2019. And it's a partnership service. So it's made up of 10 local organisations, community and voluntary organisations, and each delivering services, activities and groups which reflect their specialism. So, for example, we have Age UK delivering an information and advice service. We have switchboard delivering groups and activities for members of the LGBTQ community. We have the community development groups working within their established areas, so Hangleton and Knoll Project delivering a range of activities and groups, Trust for Developing Communities doing the same in the east of Brighton. And we also have a single point of contact service that's led by Impact Initiatives, who are the lead provider of the Ageing Well service, who I work for. And a single point of contact service is really just the gateway into Ageing Well. So anybody who wanted to find out about what was available to them in Brighton and Hove, whether they wanted to join a social group or access a music class, or perhaps they're looking for advice about access to benefits, then they can call this one single point of contact phone number or send us an email, and one of our advisors will talk through their needs and their wishes and link them up with appropriate services. So it's really to make accessing services much more straightforward for people. And it's really the ethos of Ageing Well is about encouraging well-being and improving health and ensuring that people have opportunities to age well whilst living in the city.
What is the phone number to contact you for information about Ageing Well as an organisation?
At the moment, due to the pandemic and having to change the way that we worked, we have a mobile number, which is the single point of contact service number, which is 07770061072. And of course, if anybody needs us to call them back, we will do that. But we're open Monday to Friday, 9 till 5. If you're unsure about anything, then just give us a call. Our advisors are extremely friendly and knowledgeable about what's available in the city.
And how do people find out more about the festival? For example, how long does it run for? What are the start and finish dates? And how do you book for events?
So the festival runs from Monday, the 20th of September, through to Monday, 4th of October. And we will be distributing a programme widely across the city. It will also be on the Ageing Well Festival website. So www.agingwellfestival.org. And this will be available from week commencing the 23rd of August. The programme will be available. And to book events, so all instructions are in the programme to book events. There's one phone number that you need to call Impact Initiatives. As lead coordinator of the festival, we manage all the bookings so that it's really kind of straightforward for people. And we can also, you know, answer any questions and provide any further information that people are looking for.
Is that still the 07770 phone number that you've just given us, or is it a different number?
That will be a different number. So, yeah, if you look out for the programme, or if you, have any questions before the programme is available, you can call that 0777 number and we can answer any questions through the single point of contact service.
That sounds really good. Thank you very much for that, Louise.
Thank you.
Maya Davis was talking to Louise Pame of the Ageing Well Festival. The festival runs from Monday the 20th of September to Monday the 4th of October. And you can find out more about it from either of two phone numbers, one of which is 07770 061 072, and the other is 01273 322 947. You can also find out information from their website, which is www.agingwellfestival.org. That's www.agingwellfestival.org. Now, just recently, I was reading an article in one of the local magazines about the Brighton Twins. which, if you've never heard of them, are two amazingly old elm trees standing side by side in Preston Park. That is, they were standing side by side until very recently, but unfortunately one of them sustained a lot of damage and eventually died. The other tree is still there. Now, rather than throw this amazingly old dead tree away, it was decided to try and preserve it and perhaps turn it into a sculpture and return it to its original location alongside its still living twin. A suitable area had to be found in which this work could be done, and it was decided to do it in the secret garden in Kemp Town. Now, although I've lived in Brighton for over 40 years, I'd never actually heard about there being such a thing as a secret garden, so I decided to find out more. A bit of research on the internet put me in touch with Professor Gavin Henderson, who's the chair of the Anthony Dale Trust, the trust which runs the secret garden. And on a slightly damp morning a few weeks ago, I went down to the garden, armed with a recorder, to talk to him about it. I began by pointing out that it must be pretty secret, as I hadn't heard of it, and asked him to tell me more.
Well, it's been here for a great many years. I don't know if people know the history of these gardens. This is the last one, but behind Sussex Square and part of Lewes Crescent, many of the houses had these gardens, which they got to through a tunnel from the main house, because of the road going immediately round the back of these squares and so forth. And the garden you see here, which is quite a substantial, you know, anybody having this as their private garden would say that you would feel they've got a really significant piece of land. In fact, there was it went further. So beyond the trees to the east side of the garden, there's now some blocks of flats, and that area was in fact the kitchen garden. So this garden you see here would have been the recreational garden, where they would have come to possibly played croquet and so forth here. But then you go beyond a rather decrepit flint wall over there, and they would have had a very substantial kitchen garden. And this garden was purchased privately by Anthony Dale, who was the founder of the Regency Society and a great figure in terms of conservation, not just in Brighton. He really established the conservation of buildings when he was working for the Department for the Environment. Anyway, he bought this garden to protect it, really, because he realised it was the last one. It's got a very high wall all around it, and for many, many years it was just a garden for he and his wife, Yvonne. And funnily enough, I mean, now we've got it in the ownership of a trust. We've opened it up, and people who live in the area, some of them have been living here for up to 30 years, said, "Oh, we never knew this was here." So it was a well-kept secret. Anthony had left it to Brighton Council, actually, to come to them after his death and after Yvonne's death. He said, stipulated that she must have it until she died, and then it would go to the council. And I was chairing the Regency Society at that time, which Anthony had founded. And we were very nervous because we thought, well, if it goes to Brighton Council, it's very unlikely that they would maintain it. They've got parks and gardens and things to look after, but this would be a cost which they probably wouldn't feel like meeting. And indeed, I got an assurance from several councillors, including then Steve Bassam, now the Lord Bassam, who lives only around the corner, to say they wouldn't be able to uphold the conditions of the bequest. And I didn't realise that you can actually posthumously change the terms of a will. It's a complicated legal exercise. We went through all of that. The long and the short of it is, in the end, we formed a little trust. Whilst Yvonne Dale was still alive, to assure her how it would be preserved and kept. It's not cheap. It costs us getting on for about £20,000 a year to maintain and run the garden. And we have no other income, other than, you know, trusts, foundations, donations, and now a brisk trade in weddings, which is coming along rather well.
Well, it certainly looks like an ideal spot for a wedding, assuming that the weather's good.
Well, we're sitting under this loggia in the garden, which we had to re-roof. We've had a lot of expenditure in terms of restoration here, but this is where the weddings take place. Up to 30 people can be accommodated in here. And the wedding car can come down the ramp. See, looking over the corner of the garden, you can see two big gates and a slope coming down here. Well, that wasn't there. The original access to the garden was just the little tiny staircase in the other corner. But one of the things we felt we had to do was ensure disabled access and the ability to bring small trucks and deliveries and so forth into the garden. So that's where we now can bring certain vehicles in. And it's rather nice that, you know, wedding parties can actually have the one car come in here. And the guests can also be standing around and about in this beautiful garden.
Yes, it is a very attractive garden.
A lot of people ask how can they see the garden, and we open it publicly every Sunday now through to the end of September. It's amazing how much damage can be sort of given to the garden by people running around in it, so we have to sort of limit the amount of access. But on Sundays from 11 in the morning till 5 in the evening, we're open and welcome to anybody who wants to come. And there's teas and lovely cakes available here, which you have to pay for, of course. But they're going down really very well. So through to about the last weekend in September on a Sunday.
Is there an admission charge?
There's no admission charge, but we encourage donations. And people are, by and large, pretty generous. We think, given the way in which it was left for the benefit of the community, that we shouldn't penalise people who can't afford to come in. And on certain occasions, it will probably be possible to see the sculptress, Elpida, working on the Great Elm.
Oh, yes, I was going to ask you about that. It's the remains of an elm tree standing in one corner with some wooden scaffolding sort of holding it up almost. I gather that's one of the Preston twins.
It is, and it's allegedly the oldest elm in the world, even though it's no longer alive and growing as a tree. But those two elms in Preston Park were very special. And I think most people know that this Dutch elm disease has returned, and Brighton has a very good record of dealing with the elms and treating them. But this one that had to be, it had died and had to be cut down. And they were very, very concerned about it. A lot of the other elms that have had to be felled have simply gone to the back of Waterhall Park and they're burnt there. And so the council, to give them their due, wanted to find some way of preserving it and knew about this particular sculptor who worked with trees of this kind and approached her. And then she was already talking to us about a sculpture exhibition that we will be having in the garden next year to coincide with the Brighton Festival. And she wondered whether there was a chance of bringing the elm here so that she could work on it and then it would become part of that exhibition. And that indeed is what has now happened. Getting it in here was another story altogether, and very difficult indeed. We had a crane and a low-loading truck. It was an immense task, and at one stage, one of the truck drivers just shrugged his shoulders and said, you know, this isn't going to happen. But determination is another thing, and there it is.
A bit reminiscent of the song Right Said Fred, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
So the sculpture exhibition is taking place next year?
Yes. It's been deferred for several years, actually, because of the COVID-19 crisis. One of the things we've sort of specified the garden for is as a sculpture exhibition space. We've had two big exhibitions, and one by the artist William Pye. His water sculptures were a huge success a couple of years ago. So this exhibition is of four artists. One of them, Kenneth Armitage, is now deceased, but he's one of Britain's major sculptors. And there'll be three generations of sculptors, really, making up this exhibition, which will open towards the end of April, well, mid-April next year, and run through May. And that'll be every weekend in that period, including Saturdays and Sundays.
And is it likely to become a regular event, do you think?
Oh, yes. Our intention is to have a major sculpture show every year, usually to coincide with the Brighton Festival as part of the International Festival programme. And then later in the year, we would like to be able to have a second exhibition with, say, young emerging artists to give them a chance here. The only thing is it's got to work around the kind of wedding programme as well. So weddings tend to be on Saturdays, but we've kept Sundays clear, as I say, for public access and people wanting to come with families. And dogs are very welcome if they're on a lead. We have to keep them on a lead because we've got a family of foxes who live here who really think it is their garden, so we've got to respect that.
Is the Brighton twin that's here going to stay here, or is it going back to Preston Park eventually?
Ah, very good question. The intention certainly is that it should go back to join its twin in Preston Park and stand there as a really major piece of sculpture. She's got all sorts of ideas. What you can't easily see from where we're sitting now, but round the back, it's hollowed out, the whole of this major tree, which looks like sort of elephant feet, and is quite an extraordinary piece of sculpture in its own right now. But her intention is to gild it inside. So it should get back to Preston Park in truly a glittering state.
And its twin in Preston Park is presumably still healthy.
Still alive, yes. It's wonderful to think, you know, back in the 17th century, you know, the various people who would have encountered those trees. You know, one thinks of the Prince Regent coming to Brighton in his coach and four, as it were. He would have, as he went through the Preston Park area, he would have seen these two elms, and they were there long before he was.
Were they actually in what was then the garden of Preston Manor?
I suppose it was. The garden now, Preston Manor has a lovely walled garden, contained garden, and the little church there. I haven't done the real historical survey about how far the grounds extended that were attached to the house. But yes, I'm sure they were part of the parkland that was then privately owned by the house.
OK, well, thanks very much, Gavin. So, to recapitulate, the garden here is open on Saturdays and Sundays.
No, it's open on Sundays.
It's only open on Sundays?
Only on Sundays during this year. Saturdays tends to be wedding day, but Sundays, every Sunday through to the end of September, from 11 o'clock till 5 o'clock, the garden is open, admission free, donations encouraged and welcome. And there's good catering, teas, coffees and lovely cakes.
And more practical consideration, where actually is it?
Right, it's on the corner. It makes up the corner of Bristol Gardens and Bristol Place, to the east of Sussex Square. And the bus route up here is the number 7, the 1 and the 1A are good. And I think the 23 also. Get off at the stop before Lidl's. All I would say is that people should look at the website, which is www.secretgarden2wordskemptown1word, and we update it with news about openings and special events and so forth. We look forward to welcoming more people here as it becomes less of a secret.
Gavin Henderson, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
I was talking to Professor Gavin Henderson about the Secret Garden in Kemp Town. The garden's open to the public every Sunday afternoon between now and the end of September. And you can find out more by going to their website, which is www.secretgardenkemptown, typed all as one word, .co.uk. Well, I think we'd all like to know where our hard-earned cash is spent. While much ground has been made with shopping sustainably and locally in the last few years, it looks as if many of us can't say the same for the place where our money is actually deposited. It's easy to forget that where we store our money has consequences beyond our own savings. However, new research released by the Co-op Bank shows that 40% of Britons want to say in how their bank tackles key social and environmental issues. To find out more, I spoke to Maria Kearns, Managing Director, Customers and People at the Co-op Bank, and I asked her to explain what is meant by ethical banking.
Ethical banking for the cooperative bank is absolutely at the heart of what it does, and it's what it's done for 150 years. And for me, it really is the same now as what it was then, which is being kind of a driving force for good. So we do that through our customer-led ethical policy, which has mandated a set of, you know, really fantastic things. We've been carbon neutral since 2007. We have no plastic in our debit cards. We campaign on a range of social issues. And we decline customers who don't meet our ethical standards. And whilst we've been kind of fine-tuning those credentials, consumers have moved towards us and are absolutely demanding action from their banks. Today we released some new research which showed that since the pandemic, ethical consumerism is on the rise, and 40% of UK adults want a say in how their bank tackles big social and particularly environmental issues.
I know the Co-op Bank sets great store by its ethical principles, but of course there are a lot of other banks around that people are using. How can an individual find out whether his or her bank is ethical?
It's a really, really good question. You know, as consumers, we've all got a voice and we've all got a choice to make ethical decisions. And banking is absolutely crucial. You know, choosing a bank has a huge impact on your personal carbon footprints. And we need more clarity on the banks with stronger credentials. We know that a third of consumers would switch banks to ones who are making an ethical difference, but only 15% of consumers know what their own bank's sustainability rating is. So there's lots of things we can do. The Cooperative Bank website has all our research and our latest ESG ratings. But also we would advise consumers to look at their own bank's ratings and see whether they think it's good enough for them.
I see. And this information is on the Co-op Bank website, is it?
It is, yes. It's all available on the website.
You've just conducted some research just recently. What did it show?
So the research has really said that since the pandemic, ethical consumerism is just on the march. 40% of consumers want a say in how their bank tackles big issues. But it also calls out exactly what it is that consumers are concerned about. So, you know, the top five issues are climate change, absolutely number one, with adequate healthcare, poverty, mental health and animal welfare as the issues that consumers really want their banks to tackle in a different way. For the Cooperative Bank, we're launching our ethical poll, which is the largest poll of its kind, and it will ask our 3.3 million customers what matters to them. And we'll use that information to refresh our ethical policy next year.
Would you say that banks are becoming more ethical?
So I think banks are absolutely becoming more ethical. They are more aware of their obligations. You know, I think the pandemic has certainly made us all kinder and more connected. You know, we collectively faced the challenges we saw and we were more aware of the inequalities that we see. And I think we all acted kind of little by little to build up a more united society. And I think this can become like a kind of kindness muscle. So as we come out of the pandemic, businesses are very aware that consumers are expecting more from them. And I think, you know, I know that as we talk about the climate and ecological emergency bill, it is around stepping up and taking our responsibilities more seriously.
And are other companies other than banks tending to become more ethical, do you think?
I do, yes. I think that you can see just by walking on the high streets, all shops, all businesses, all restaurants are keen to show their ethical credentials and where they're making a difference and where they're trying to help. I think the important thing is that this is not about marketing. This is about a genuine set of meaningful steps to help improve both society and clearly the impact that we're having on the environment.
So you're not specifically asking people to move their accounts to the Co-op Bank, but you're asking banks in general to become more ethical.
Absolutely. We're asking consumers to make a choice. So we're asking consumers to educate themselves on exactly what their bank does, educate themselves on what the best banks can do, and to make the right choices about that. We would love to have UK consumers who want to make an ecological and social difference to join the cooperative bank. But we also want the banking industry to step as one to improve its impact on society.
You said the information's on your website. Can you just give me the address of the website again?
Yes, of course. It's www.thecooperativebank.co.uk.
Maria, thank you very much. I was talking to Maria Kearns of the Co-op Bank about the concept of ethical banking. To find out more, you can go to the Co-op Bank website, which is www.thecooperativebank.co.uk. typed all as one word, .co.uk. Well, it seems that during the recent pandemic, there's been an increase in cycling, and not just ordinary pedal cycles, but people using a new device, which is known as an e-bicycle. To find out more about it, I spoke to a former professional cyclist, Daniel Lloyd, and to Tamara Winograd of Bosch e-bike systems, who are one of the main manufacturers of e-bikes. And I began by asking Tamara how long e-bikes have been on the scene.
Oh, e-biking is something that has a long story, because in fact it's coming from the original bicycle, as you are still have to pedal with an e-bike. So that's a big difference to a motorcycle or to a moped. So you are still like on a normal bicycle, you need to pedal, you can choose how much you do exercise by choosing the mode of support that you have, and it follows also the rules of a bicycle, of course. So in Europe, you can say the starting point was something like around 10 years ago. And since that time, we see really an increase in the UK, but also across Europe and really in the world for e-bikes.
So an e-bike isn't like the old petrol engine mopeds that I remember from when I was young, where in fact, although you had pedals, you could actually run on the engine full time if you wanted to. You just use the pedals to give you an extra thrust when pushing off.
No, you have to always pedal for you to get any assistance back from an e-bike. So there's no magic throttle on the handlebars that you just press to travel along with no effort at all. But that, in many respects, is the beauty of them. And obviously what separates them from motorbikes or modern mopeds, etc., is that, you know, you're still getting exercise and therefore you're still getting health benefits. But you can choose, as Tamara said, how much of an assistance it gives you, in effect, how much it's sort of giving you an extra push. So if you're going on your way to work and you don't want to get a sweat on, you might want to choose the maximum assistance so you get there with the least effort. And on the way back, when it doesn't matter because you can have a shower as soon as you get home, you might want to be on your own pedal power, get a proper workout, or choose one of the other levels of assistance in between. But you always have to be pedaling an e-bike for it to be helping you.
Right. What's it like going up hills? Because in Brighton, where I live, it's very hilly. And in fact, I live on top of a hill.
It's the best thing ever, Richard. You've got to get yourself on one. To answer your question fully, that's where they really come into their own, I think, on the climbs. Because I think that's what puts a lot of people off cycling in the first place. It's not that hard without assistance to travel along at 10, 12, 15 miles per hour on a normal bike. The e-bike will give you assistance on the flat, but it's when you start to go uphill and you're fighting against gravity, that extra help is very much needed. And there are plenty of places around the country where people are put off cycling because the terrain is so extreme, really, and the assistance you get from an e-bike speeds you up them in no time.
Tamara, coming back to you, there are different types of e-bike, aren't there, with different functions?
Absolutely. In the past, there was, in fact, really one type of e-bike, and that was the feeling that it's a little bit cheating, or it's a little bit like for people that can't make it on a normal bicycle anymore. But nowadays, there are really a broad range of models and also of drive systems. So really depending on your usage situation, what you need for your daily life, you can choose from either an urban city bike, a very stylish one. You can have a cargo bike to bring your stuff around, to transport your kids to the kindergarten, or even you have like trekking or e-mountain bikes, really to experience and to enjoy your region.
I don't suppose I'll ever get into the Olympics though.
Yeah, well, if you try to do that on an e-bike, Richard, I think you'd be expelled pretty quickly from the Olympics.
Yes. From what you're saying, it counts like an ordinary bicycle. You don't need to have a road fund licence or indeed a driving licence to use one, as you would with a moped.
No, you don't. And so therefore, there'll be people out there that have some safety concerns of inexperienced cyclists jumping on an e-bike. But to sell an e-bike in the UK, it has to be restricted to a maximum of 25 kilometres per hour. You can go faster than that, but at that point, the assistance will cut out and you'll be just running on your own power from your own two legs. But I would encourage anyone that's not particularly experienced in cycling to try and get some advice, look for it online and try using the bike in much quieter areas, even if it's off-road on a gravel track, etc. As long as it's away from pedestrians and quiet without motor vehicles, just so you get used to it and maybe used to getting back on a bike again, because it sounds like you've not been on one for a while, Richard.
No, I haven't. The last time I was on a pedal cycle was in my late teens. And I'm now in my mid-70s, so I know you don't forget the technique, as everyone always tells you, but obviously the question is, am I fit enough if I wanted to take up an e-bike?
Well, that's the beauty of e-bikes. And yeah, there's that old saying, isn't it? It's like riding a bike, you know, that you never forget a skill that you learnt when you were young. So the fact that you've not been on it since you were 17, I don't think should be a barrier to you just trying one out. You know, I would advise starting on soft ground just in case. But you'll soon get the balance. And the thing with bikes is the faster they're going, the more the wheels help you balance. You know, if you're trying to go along very slowly, that's when you're going to find balance more of an issue. And so the very fact that e-bikes get you off the mark pretty quickly and up to, you know, not a fast speed, but up to, let's say, 10 miles per hour very quickly, that should assist you in your balance and therefore your confidence.
So I know you would recommend e-bikes to all sorts of people, but would recommend them even to people my sort of age, people who haven't really taken much exercise and certainly haven't ridden a bike for a long time?
I think so, yeah. There are plenty of examples of people out there who've either barely ever ridden a bike or have had a long period like yourself where they've not been on one. And they're very daunted by the local hills that we talked about a few moments ago. But they soon find that they're lowering the amount of assistance that they are choosing on their e-bike because they're still pedaling. They're still starting to get a fitness and a strength from using the e-bike, even on the maximum assistance. And they soon start to come down and eventually can find that they can do that same route, even on an e-bike, which is heavier than a normal bike, without any extra assistance at all. So, you know, it's not completely cheating. You are still putting effort in. And with that comes fitness. And also, I think it's a general good feeling, really, after you've been on an e-bike.
And presumably you have to charge the battery in the bike up overnight or whenever.
Yeah, exactly. You need to charge your battery, of course, but that's a very easy process. You can use your normal electricity infrastructure, and the timing is really short, so it's just a few hours from zero to full loaded battery. So it gives you really the possibility to go around like 50 kilometers easily. So there's no real risks that you're running out of energy for your e-bike.
And I suppose if you did, the worst happened, you did run out, you can still pedal it.
Exactly.
So how available are e-bikes now?
Well, there's a bit of a supply and demand issue going on at the moment because there are so many people wanting to get on bikes for the first time. And obviously that demand came at exactly the same time where certain manufacturers were having problems and getting parts with the workforce coming to work during, you know, the COVID pandemic last year. So they're not quite as freely available as many people would like, both from a consumer point of view, but also from the manufacturers as well. But I think that will change very quickly. You know, they know that the demand is there now for e-bikes. They're on a constant upward trajectory in terms of the demand for them. So they'll be making more and more of them for the supply to be able to give that to the people that want to go out and purchase one. I think an e-bike is something that's so open to people that have got no interest in the cycling as a sport or a leisure activity, but just want to get from A to B, often in a quicker way than you can with your car. If you're living in a city, it can often be quicker to get from A to B on an e-bike than it is driving around in a car. And I think that will continue like that.
And what sort of price do they work out at?
For the e-bike itself is, of course, an investment you have to take. For the Bosch drive system with an e-bike, we say, for example, that an entry point is something like £1,800. So for this, you get a decent e-bike. And of course, it's an investment, but it's also a possibility to reduce your car kilometers. And from that up, there's almost no limit. So you can invest much more than that. And you need to take into account, of course, if you choose an e-bike, that of course you are more on this bicycle than probably on a traditional bicycle. And also the average speed that you're taking also uphill is probably higher than you would have on a traditional bicycle. So it's important that also all the components on this e-bike are in high quality and really fit for the e-bike.
And where can people find more information?
You can visit our websites at bosch-ebike.com. You will find there all kind of different drive systems that are matching the different use cases. So you can choose what kind of e-bike you need. You will find the information for that. And of course, you can find information about how far you can go with an e-bike, for example, and the local dealer around you.
That all sounds very interesting. I must look into it further. Tamara and Daniel, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Have a nice day. And try an e-bike.
I'll certainly think about it. Bye.
Bye.
And that brings this edition of At Home This Morning to an end. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard in the last hour. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in a month's time. Until then, it only remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to wish you all the very best. So until we meet again, take care and goodbye for now.